Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
All right, welcome to the Esoteric Nerd Podcast. I'm your host, Edward.
And who, something strange is happening.
Yeah, something strange is happening. He's transplanted into my body. See, his wireless, his 5G wireless internet in India transported his soul into my body, and now I'm going to be Edward for the remainder of this podcast. It's all right. Sweet. Aquarians and Virgos have a lot in common. We're both very mercurial, so I'm sure I can handle it.
And here I was afraid that you were going to be RC the whole time.
No, that guy sucks. And who we got? We have Joseph Zabinski, Frater Mercurio, and Matt.
Yes, sir.
We need to say more than just Matt, because after all those other names, that's sort of like, and the NPC.
Frater ISCP.
I like it. I like it.
Yes, sir.
ISCP, man.
That sounds Egyptian. Yeah, that sounds like Inseti.
It does.
So what's going on, for those who don't know, is that you guys, we're in the middle of a podcast with Edward, and his internet died in India, right? Is that what happened?
That's correct.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, the connection went down.
Okay. And we can just pick off where he left off or do whatever we want, I guess.
We were discussing, really, Matt had some questions for us as Adepti. We had some really cool questions. So we were being interviewed by Matt, really. Mm-hmm. Frater ISCP.
I will turn it over to Frater Matt, ISCP. And what order are you in, brother?
Right now, I'm just kind of doing my own thing, but I was involved with the lodge in Toronto.
With Zach?
No, not with Zach. That was the first thing we said, too.
Yeah.
with what order? Like Cicero's?
Yes. Yeah, correct. Yeah.
They have a lodge in Toronto?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
But we're not supposed to know that.
I'm sure you can Google it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they have a list of all their temples. They have a list. Actually, someone the other day just told me that I must be a member of the Cicero's temple in Toronto because I was like, no, I live in Vancouver, where you live. And she's like, well, there's no Golden Dawn in Vancouver. I'm like, there's lots of Golden Dawn in Vancouver, just none that the Ciceros recognize, I guess. I mean, we got Frater Yeshi and the Thuban Temple and that whole order, which has the, like, who's in that? Chris Zaleski, Darcy Kuntz is in that, right? According to the website, I believe. And then there's other groups. So, yeah. I think I was very saddened recently to see who's the Hierophant in England? Sumner. Yeah?
Alex Sumner.
Yeah. Pretend like you don't exist and there's no other Golden Dawn in the UK. Like, you know. Yeah, he was very clear about that, about like there's no other groups here and there's no other options and there's no one else. It's like, and I was upset by that, because I'm like, you know you're lying. You know you're lying. Yeah. You know you're actually lying.
And we go to the same Masonic lodge.
Exactly. And I was just like, this is the kind of stuff that needs to stop, in my opinion. Because as long as this stuff's going on, like, we're talking about the tradition that I'm part of, like where my heart is, but it's hard to respect a tradition when you have representatives of it like behaving that way. So anyway, I hope
that, however, I mean, leave that in the past. I do have to say that it's quite nice in some ways to be secret and anonymous and truly secret.
You get a lot of control that way. You can initiate whoever you want to initiate. If you don't want to, you don't have to. It's very easy to maneuver when people don't know you're there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
We have quite a few members who are brand new to magic, or brand new to the Golden Dawn. So that's been really good. you know, really interesting.
Yeah, I don't think it's not a, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily for you to have that sort of, you know, it's disappointing to me to see a Hierophant and a representative like that talk like this. I'm just so tired of it. Like, I've been dealing with zinc since the 90s, you know, and you know, I had to deal with zinc. I've had Griffin break into my house. I've had other heads of current Golden Dawners do vicious things to my family. Like, I love the tradition, but that stuff, if it just doesn't ever get called out, and if people just put up with it, what do you think is going to happen? We've all seen now in the world what happens when us plebs neglect our responsibility in our roles in being a part of life, right? This is how we ended up with all these nut jobs running all these countries, clearly, is because we just abdicated all responsibility. I mean, that's the only way that could have happened, right? Is if we just stopped really caring about who we elected, because whether we like it or not, and all the jokes that we all, you know, is easy to make about fascism and all that stuff. Well, believe it or not, we actually do vote in our people, right? So if we got a bunch of, you know, if you don't like the people there, it's, well, look in the mirror. Yeah. So, and I don't like seeing that this happen and this be perpetuated in the Golden Dawn community, because what's the point in claiming that we're practicing magic for spiritual development if we're going to still behave poorly, right? Like then magic really should have nothing to do with spirituality, like Stephen Skinner says. You know, it should be completely separated. Either it should be taken seriously, using magic for spirituality, or I say separate the two altogether, which isn't going to happen. And which is why we just need to, you know, get a little bit of maturity and maybe hold people to slightly higher standards. Like, don't pretend that you don't exist. Yeah.
Just exist. I hear what you're saying, brother. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, Matt, did you, do you have any other questions?
Yeah, definitely. Where did we leave off? We left off of, I guess, the importance of the death of the ego. I think that's where we left off, right?
Oh, yeah. And the we were talking about the higher genius. Yeah, the HGA and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess, have you guys ever tried psychedelics before?
Do you mean psychedelics in the context of Golden Dawn ritual work?
No, I mean like LSD,
DMT, just to take LSD,
magic mushrooms. Yeah, like with intention. But yeah, have you guys ever tried?
Oh yeah, that? Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. I've never like I've never really been interested in like tripping out when I'm doing Golden Dawn work. I find that like Golden Dawn work essentially trips me out plenty. And so I don't really want to go beyond like where it's pushing me. Golden Dawn work has pushed me to mental limits before. I'm just not really interested in trying to push beyond that using drugs. Was that your question? Just our relationship with psychedelics?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we talk about the death of the ego, right? And I think that psychedelics are a great way to quickly see what the death of the ego is like if you take enough. So
take enough.
If you take enough, you can find out what the death of the ego is like and what the death of the body is like.
And Christ consciousness, right?
You could do both.
You're right. But I would say mainly psychedelics are pretty safe for you. You're not going to die. You may think you're going to die, but magic mushrooms, LSD, if you're with the right people, right sitters and right setting, I think it's 100% safe. Definitely.
Yeah.
In fact, I think in the future, within the next like 5 to 10 years, I could see psychedelics being used accompanied by psychotherapy for people with PTSD, severe depression. Like I think that you'll see a huge change in shift in perception. Just like, well, you're from Canada, Frater RC, like, you know, cannabis 10 years ago, very like looked down upon. Now you can buy it at any corner store. I'm not saying it's going to be like that with psychedelics. I think it's going to be more medicinal purposes. I was just interested in your guys' take on that.
I'll tell you what interests me is the ayahuasca and all of that. I mean, I know somebody who used to run ceremonies in Peru using ayahuasca, and she said that she got some really great results from that, you know, helping people. But it was done in the shamanistic context, and, you know, in quite a, you know, in a way that was geared up to focus things on specific experiences. So I've never done that, but it would be something I'd consider, I think. The other thing I've heard a lot about recently is microdosing with psilocybin and ayahuasca. And I know somebody in California who does that, and that seems to work really well for her. And kind of has given her a new lease of life and a new perspective on herself. So yeah, I think it has its place for sure. I don't know if it has its place in the Golden Dawn at all, but certainly in other situations. And some people need that to break them open in a way. Others don't, in my viewpoint. So I don't have anything against it. I just wonder how controlled it is. And as you say, if it's done in a kind of safe and proper way, it probably does help a great deal, you know.
Definitely.
I've been microdosing all week. I got this huge, huge mushroom like this big, and I just take a tiny little piece off of it and I just eat it. And my theory of microdosing, like, well, when I microdose, I like to actually microdose. I'm not talking about small doses. The idea is that you can't tell, right? You don't notice the difference.
That's it. Like,
if someone is taking a chunk of something or whatever it is that I guess you're doing and like, you know, and then getting a little slight trippy buzz all day, that's not really microdosing. Like, that's a small dose. That's definitely dosing, because you're noticing a conscious difference. The idea of microdosing is it's having sort of an effect and you don't even notice it. And that is something you do notice. You notice that you don't notice anything but feel slightly different all day. And that's what you can take. And it doesn't matter how small the amount is, I've noticed. And it does make a difference. And it makes such a difference to functionality and creativity and work ethic. That Silicon Valley, for example, has been doing this for ages, to the extent that they now believe they can say that companies that don't have their employees microdosing on psilocybin are at a competitive disadvantage. And that's 100% the language. Agree. That's the language that really is powerful, because the second you tell shareholders, hey, our company's at a competitive disadvantage, we know this mathematically, because our staff aren't microdosing psilocybin. The second you can say that officially, that's when you'll see things change.
The science is there, my friend. You're right. Like, it's it has an effect in neurogenesis, right?
Yeah.
So it's repairing of the brain tissue. You're actually like expanding the mind. You're expanding the consciousness. You're lighting up different areas of the brain that you weren't using before, right? Like, science says we only use 10% of the brain. Even if we were to use a fraction or a small percentage more, it could create significant results. So I think microdosing is great, but I also do believe in macrodosing 100%. I don't know if you guys know about Terrence McKenna, but 5 dry grams, silent darkness. I think it's a great way to test your psyche. I think it's a great way to experience ego death as well. Like, if you want to, but I think you were being funny before of seeing what the afterlife is like. But when you said that, but I do believe that the effects of psilocybin and DMT, it's released actually when we're born and when we're dying in the brain. So I do, as funny as what it sounds like, I think that you're right, actually. Like, I think that, these chemicals could have a similar effect as to like what death could be like. I'm not saying it's what death is, but it's I think it's painting a picture. You're kind of breaking beyond the veil, as I'm sure you guys can relate to that terminology.
There's definitely something weird going on with our pineal gland, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as, I mean, to answer your question, Matt, like, yeah, I've done the macro dosing thing for sure. You asked about that specifically. And
yeah.
And yeah, like I've believed I was dead for hours, many, many hours, and was walking around thinking people couldn't see me and that I was dead for hours and hours and hours after I took about 9 tabs of acid. And that was really good. I was very suicidal before that. And because my best friend had killed herself and a lot of other things that sort of happened, and I didn't really know what to do. And I talked to the counselor, the therapist I was seeing afterward, and told him about the results of that 9-dose trip where I, you know, basically I thought I was dead for a long period. And it was just a ghost walking around, like walking up and down the same stairs, like for 2 hours, you know, because when I get to the top, I thought I had to, was supposed to go to the bottom. When I got to the bottom, I thought I was supposed to go to the top. And that's how I spent a couple hours that day. And when I told him about the results, like everything was changed after the trip, right? Like, obviously I didn't really want to die, but having my friend kill herself in such a horrific way and everything, all the fallout from that, like, I don't know how you can't be sort of damaged from it, right? I'm not sure how I could have not been damaged. So what do you do in that situation? How do you get out of that situation? Sometimes not all forms of spirituality are enough, like, and sometimes people don't know what to say to you. And the therapist said something very interesting. He said, you know, it's a shame that we can't recommend this in certain situations ever, because he said, you're exhibiting all the positive effects that we could hope for from such a treatment. He said, in fact, you're exhibiting all the positive signs, the most positive signs that you can expect from electroshock therapy. He's like, yep. If electroshock therapy goes really well, the person exhibits these sort of signs, and you're exhibiting them all from, you know, macrodosing acid. And he said, he was very glad that I did that. He was like, I'm very glad. He's like, you're completely changed. Like, and, you know, I kept seeing him for many, many months just to make sure that I was sort of stabilized in that new space, after that horrific experience. And it was good. It was good. Yeah, it totally worked. I have a lot of friends who were in really specialized service branches in the Canadian government. That's probably the correct way to describe what they did. You know, but these are people who, like, you know, were in Afghanistan shooting kids every day. And they would tell me about this, and they'd be like, yeah, we had to really shoot kids all the time, because the kids had guns and were coming at us, right? And it's like, oh shit, well, most of us can't imagine that. You know, he used microdosing MDMA to get off PTSD, and I know a lot of people have done that. When I heard that, that's how I then dealt with that. And so, yeah, very effective there.
The science is all coming out now. There's different companies that are coming out, and it's a serious thing. I mean, yeah, I'm so glad that the medicine worked for you. I don't like to refer to it as a drug. I like to refer to psychedelics as medicines, because I've seen so many different positive cases of people coming off opiate addictions, again, PTSD, severe depression, like, and these are no, this is no joke. Like, if you look at how depressing, like we were speaking at the beginning of the episode, of how depressing it's been not being able to go out and socialize and live a normal life. We have multiple people, probably more than what you'd recognize, in different states of depression. And now more than ever, I think that we need these medicines. They've been proven to work, and they've been out for, I mean, magic mushrooms, thousands of years. So, and again, very safe. If you know what you're doing, and again, the setting is proper, your intention is pure, I think that there's a reason why they're called magic mushrooms. Miracles can be worked with these things.
Yeah.
That's my own personal opinion. And Yeah, again, I think in the future these medicines are going to be legalized, and the MDMA, like, again, it just, you're able to open up, right? Like, if it's I mean, MDMA is kind of different. You have to be careful because it's a chemical compound. Like, it's not an organic like magic mushrooms, but if you get it from a reputable source and you have these great loving experiences, I think that there's a lots of healing that can be done. And yeah, I know it's a little bit of off Golden Dawn topic, but I mean, that's what magic is about, right? Healing the soul, killing the ego, or
So
we actually have like there's actually like three mushroom dispensaries on my street here.
Oh really,
Matt?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Have you tried the penis envy?
Oh, big time! I've
man, that sent me on astral journey. Not even joking. It like it was almost. I was tears of happiness were coming out of my eyes because of how much love I felt. I felt like a little kid. How. I don't know how to describe it, but I mean, I've worked with magic mushrooms for a bit now, and all I can say is all my journeys have been amazing.
The point about I think entheogens and magic is that that you don't hear people talk about a lot is even when you're just using hashish or something,
yeah,
it makes it a lot harder to focus. It's very hard to focus on the work you're doing, especially some of the very complex astral work we do in the Golden Dawn, which is it's real stuff. Like, I mean, if you're having to ascend from like, you know, plane to plane, sphere to sphere, and in each plane you're doing like a, you know, a whole middle pillar in that color, and then doing these other rituals all in that astral plane, that's a lot of stuff going on through your mind. And it takes a lot of focus to do it well, and to also bring that energy through so that you experience it. Like, this isn't all make-believe stuff you're just visualizing and imagining, like a lot of people these days seem to think it is. I'm not sure how this stark divide between everything that we're capable of with our consciousness has occurred versus all the rest of like grimoire and evocational magic, which is now considered like real. Like results-based magic, that's all real. And everything we do that involves imagination or the consciousness or our own natural energy is all new age make-believe. This is something recently that is quite popular to say. And I know this because people are saying it to me all the time. And I think it's complete nonsense to create this stark divide. And I think it grew out of this fake dichotomy between the so-called psychological model and the spirit model, which I don't think it's actually real. I think it's made up by people who are promoting an artificial dichotomy so that they can make certain points about whatever they want to make. Because I don't believe that I've never met anyone in my entire magical career that believes magic was all psychological and in your head. So who are these people that believe this? I think it's a straw man. Show me this movement of people. I think since this dichotomy of psychological model and spirit model has been promulgated in the popular occult scene, since then I think a lot of people have clung to the psychological model and gone to that, and it's divided people. But I don't know of any. I think it's made up. I've never encountered this in my life, and I've been in this as long as most, and at this point. And so who are these people that are like, magic only exists in our head and that's all that ever did, and who are actual serious magical practitioners, right? That's what we're talking about. Otherwise, it's not a model. If it's just some randos on the street who thinks magic exists but only in your head, I've never met these people. And I've certainly never met a serious magical practitioner who has been like, oh, I've experienced amazing things. I mean, it's all my own make-believe in my head, but I've experienced amazing things from magic. I've never heard someone say that, either in the US. I know we lost John probably due to the
his battery ran out, so he's charging his battery for 5 minutes.
He'll I was back. Wondering if we scared him off talking about plant medicine.
So I mean, one thing that I definitely notice with magic a lot is that the context is highly experiential, right? So I mean, it's a very, it can be a very subjective thing, right? You're the only one who, you know, when especially when you're first starting out, and if you're a solo practitioner, you're the only one who knows that you did magic to, for example, you know, get $30,000. So then when you end up with $30,000, you're literally the only person who knows like that there's a connection in the first place. If besides that, you only used what you only know one magical system. So let's say that, you know, it's the 15th century and you only know about image magic as proposed by, say, Ficino and Picatrix, right? If that's the only thing that you know, then you're going to have a very objective view of magic, right? You're going to be like, okay, I have to get these specific materials. I have to get this rock and this leaf and this incense and put them all together at the right time. And then $30,000 appears, right? When you do all of those things, like, you might notice some inner work happening very vaguely, but for the most part, you have an objective view, right? And so when somebody like that meets a magician who is like, I don't do anything physically, I just go to sleep and then I have dreams. Mm. I wake up inside the dream. Then after that, I meet these creatures and I ask them to do a thing and then the thing happens. That person has a very subjective view, right? And they can get, and they can argue all day about how, like, you know, about whether or not the worth of what they're doing is valid, right? But I mean, but I think that that's where, you know, and the thing is, like that's where results come in, but also it's not where results come in because it's like, did they both obtain success doing what they're trying to do? Yes. But we're talking about something that's tremendously subjective and tremendously individual to begin with, right? So are they right? I mean, I would say that they're both right. Are their techniques valid? I mean, sure. Like they both succeeded. Is there one way to do this? Nope.
Well, that's the thing. See, I totally agree. And I just think they're just not separate things. And I think that's a false dichotomy that we've created. Like, we just made it up, right? Like, mm-hmm. like saying that Americans are either red or blue. What? That's bullshit. This is make-believe. You're all human mm-hmm. beings. Oh, no, you can't have human beings. You can't have humanitarianism, because then we'd all be one and see each other as sort of part of the same global cosmic organism, and that's bad, because, you know, that's just not what it's not what the forces of darkness want. Like, the powers of Thaumiel that are coterminous with Malkut are two opposing forces. That is the whole point of that Kleptothic energy that shares the Malkut sphere with us, in theory. So yeah, it's I think fruitless to think of magic as being divorced from the psychology. I mean, this is the great gift we did get from Rigardi, is we got a psychologist who actually is a trained psychologist during the heyday of psychology. So, like, it was all really, you know, it was big stuff when he was studying psychology. Like, of course he became a psychologist. If you were alive during Freud, Jung, Reich, and all of these other cats, you'd probably become a psychologist as well. It was really cutting edge stuff. And Rigardi explored these really amazing insights in how magic affects us psychologically and how it interrelates with our psychology. But somehow that led to certain people saying that some people only believe magic is in your head and psychologically driven. And again, I don't think that's real. I don't think people, I never met people in the 90s, even in the New Age 90s, I never met anyone who thought that way, right? Everyone thought magic affects your psychology. You use your consciousness and your mind to interact with a lot of things, especially spiritual creatures. And that's just sort of the starting point, right? When you get spiritual creatures to show up through evocation and invocation and they start interacting with you, I never met anyone who was like, it's in my head, I'm visualizing it. And because you, how would that happen? Like, even in my, when I was 13 in our Wiccan coven, like, we weren't like, I'm visualizing a spirit over there. Do you guys all see it? It's like, what are you talking about? We see the spirit that's there. We can see it with our eyes. It's not in your head. What are you talking about? No one would say that. So who are these people? I think they're fictitious. I think they were made up to cause division artificially within the occult community.
Well, I mean, from what it sounds like, it just sounds like somebody read a lot of Riccardi, never really thought it through, and never really tried to go anywhere with it.
Yeah, never, certainly never practiced the Zed formula evocation, Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, you know, spirits will show up. And if you can't see them, take some mushrooms, then you'll see them. Because seriously, the thing I've noticed most, especially if you're outside of a city in nature, when you take not even that necessarily a high dose of mushrooms, is the spirits are visible. So the great breakthroughs I've had in the last couple of years using mushrooms with ritual work have been phenomenal, because the things I've seen with my eyes open, no astral sight needed, as I'm working, like especially after the circumambulations, the wisps of the spirits, like the strands of the spirits, get pulled and they circle around the altar and they move into the altar and they want to go into the crystals or the scrying bowl or whatever's there. You know, they're all getting pulled in. And I even tested out the theory of the earth pentacle, which you know, there was this old theory that if you unveiled your earth pentacle around actual tangible spirits that were present, they would all get banished because it's so grounding. It would ground them out and banish them. And that would protect you if you needed it to, like some other Solomonic devices are intended to do. But when I tried that out, it didn't work. And they all actually started swarming towards the earth pentacle. And so I asked the spirits, why are you swarming towards the earth pentacles? And they said, we like the shapes and the colors. They said,
you know what?
Like the shapes and the colors. And I was like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
It goes back to,
we were talking about colors before. And I noticed something the other day that in the Adept Oath, it specifically says, like, so it's the part where you're talking about what exactly you're going to keep secret. And it's, I forget like all the things it says that you're going to keep secret, but then it says, especially knowledge of flashing colors. It calls out flashing colors specifically.
Yeah.
And then John Chax, when he was on before, he was talking about how, or I think it was John, we were talking about how the floor is all black and white, and then you usually have like black walls around you, but then the vault itself and the tablets, it's like, it's just everything pops with like all this color. And he just made me think about how, like, because this was part of the meta discussion before, like, what is it to even be an adept? And I'm starting to think that a major part of being an adept is understanding the magic of color.
100%. It's all relative, right? Like, color is vibration itself. So it's, I think that color relates to the octaves of music. Like, it relates to music, the human body, just like the tree of life relates to the human body as well. Like, it all correlates with each other, I think.
It's definitely a part of being a Golden Dawn adept, though it's not part of, I think, all traditions, right? It's really not. It's pretty unique, really, to the Golden Dawn, is the color theory. So I'm not sure if it's distinctive of adepthood. It's just distinctive of Golden Dawn adepthood of the grade.
Yeah.
I think we should distinguish between. I do like it when people distinguish between, you know, grade titles like Adeptus and sort of general uses of these titles, because it can be helpful to understand that what we're describing is not necessarily what a lot of people think it is. It's not like we're talking about some sort of ontological change that makes one person superior to other people. And that's how a lot of people see that. And that's a problem, I think. Right, like that would be the most anti-Jesus, anti sort of Christian, and people might be surprised me saying that, but you can't take Jesus out of the Golden Dawn, especially the Inner Order initiations. I mean, it's sort of baked in, along with all, you know, Osiris and all these other god forms and beings. And therefore, it's such an anti-Christian sentiment, the idea that your closeness to God would somehow make you different in kind to other people is the exact opposite message Jesus was trying to impart to humanity in his sort of egalitarian quest of loving each other and being saved through community, which is what early Jesus was very much about. Was communal salvation. Early Christians were completely antithetically opposed to the idea of personal salvation or the idea of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That didn't exist. That was something that got made up later on. This idea of a personal relationship with Christ, not a part of the early Christian tradition whatsoever. In fact, the opposite is true. It's the idea that together in community, we become saved through, you know, participation in these rituals, which is primarily the Eucharist. And so I think that's an interesting thing worth remembering. Mm-hmm. When we talk about adepthood.
John just got back to us and he said that he's not going to be able to make it back on.
We shouldn't have talked about entheogens.
That was my bad.
We lose the Brits on that one.
Shit.
Well, we can always try to do it again, right? I mean, I think this is like time number three that we've tried to organize this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're sort of Frankensteining it together.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just going to ask Matt, do you feel like we've addressed what you were curious about?
Oh, 100%. I wish we had recorded that, the other half that wasn't recording. No, when it was just me, you and like John, like that, we had some, I think that we had some great conversations, some good topics, and like,
yes, yeah,
I could bring it up again, but we could save it for another time maybe, or I don't know, because like, it's just, I don't know, it doesn't really matter. But I was going to say, we were talking about color and vibration, and I just wanted to bring up the tarot. And so do you think that, I guess, like, let's say, well, obviously the tarot is like a very special magical tool and the trumps are the major arcana. I was just wondering, if, let's say someone is uninitiated, and they just start looking at the images itself, do you think that it could produce some magical effect? Just because the color, the vibration, the symbolism on the card, like I think that Aleister Crowley said that the tarot, the cards themselves are living beings, right? So do you think that even just picking up a tarot deck, being uninitiated, could create some magical effect within the mind?
I think for it to be a magical effect, you need training and tension and practice, because magic isn't as loose as like Aleister Crowley would have us believe in his definition. It has a lot more to do with leveraging spirits or your spirit. So there has to be that trained leveraging for it to be, you know, magic. Otherwise, gotcha. Lots of things can occur, I think. I mean, strong psychics, you know, they go into trances or have visions when they, you know, pick up the most random things sometimes, like psychometrically, or, you know, with tarot cards in the colors and have visions or go on little trips. I mean, Yeats would just walk around with his tatwas in his pocket. And, you know, every time someone had him over for tea, he would pull out a tatwa and see how many people in the household he could get into a shared pathworking vision. It wasn't exactly a party trick, but it was, he really believed that something was going on with the way in which our minds merge together and have these sort of shared experiences. And so, yeah, he was really into seeing just what happened when the average unsuspecting peasant in the Irish countryside, where he would travel around collecting stories, what they'd experience when he'd below Tatwa's and go on these little journeys. I mean, we only have a few notes of his like mentioning these sort of things, but other people wrote in their letters and journals like slight references to it. That's why we know he did it quite a bit, you know. So it's very interesting.
Very cool.
So I think spontaneous things can occur for sure, of course, from, you know, depending on someone's sensitivity. Otherwise, you need sort of an operational thing to set it up to cause it to happen or to lead someone who's controlled into that experience.
I think it's important to understand that we're not entirely in charge of what I'll call a spiritual experience, right? So, you know, if, you know, I think a lot about, so my wife is very much involved in meditation, right? And I'll see her just perform like a simple meditation and visualization, and it's like, you know, it's as if a magus did this work. Like I'll see her do stuff and then like everything changes. And it's like this masterful, technique that I see coming out of her. And she didn't have to, she just did a simple meditation. If I did that simple meditation, I don't expect that I would get much of anywhere with it. I've done meditations like that before. And it, you know, I've done meditations like that before, and I've seen an effect over, say, 10 years, very subtle, not like her explosive experiences. And so just watching her work has taught me a lot about how like some people have gifts that we're not in charge of who gets those gifts, you know? So yeah, to answer your question, it's like if somebody is just naturally inclined towards working with colors, for example, and they come along a brilliantly colored tarot deck, then sure, yeah, I would think that there is something to be said for personal gifts.
And now, a word from our sponsors. While we cannot control whether any ads get put in the spots allocated, we thank you for listening to those that do, since they help keep this project alive. You can also get ad-free content and bonus content and videos and a private webpage by subscribing exclusively to magicwithoutfears.com for only a couple dollars a week, or $6 a month, or $50 for the year. It helps a lot, plus you get emails about other exclusive things. Thank you very much.
It's interesting that in the Golden Dawn, and people, I think, forget this and get confused about this. At least that's what I see when I see people talking about it, especially when they change the colors or they mute the colors of the tools or mess around with that sort of stuff. They think that we use the colors to represent the elements, right? For example, with the elemental tools. They think we use these colors because they represent the elements. And then, of course, the flashing form causes the trippy effect that we all enjoy so much who have worked with these things properly, and help you, you know, access that force. But this is a mistake, because if that was true, you can make it any color you want and call it whatever you want. You just make it up. You can just say, you know, pink is earth and turquoise is fire. And, you know, that's my color correspondences. That's my set. But that's not what the Golden Dawn believes. They believe that colors don't represent forces. They believe that colors are forces. So as soon as you change the color, you say you don't like the bright colors of the elemental weapons in the Golden Dawn, so you change them. Okay, so no, they are no longer Golden Dawn tools. They no longer represent the forces that all the other Golden Dawn tools represent. When you change the color, you change the colors on the rainbow or lotus wand, then they're no longer the zodiacal colors or the forces. It's not that you've used different colors to represent the zodiac. You're no longer using the zodiacal forces because you're not using the colors that are those forces. And I think it's very funny how similar, like, it seems like they just sort of took this idea from Rudolf Steiner, but I think Steiner, I think they weren't familiar with Steiner in 1888 when they started putting out writings to these effects and developing this understanding. I don't think they were very familiar. I don't think they were familiar with Steiner's work at all in those days. So it looks like they developed along parallel lines.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm curious.
Man, I have a question for you. Do you want to go to Philosophus?
Definitely.
Do you see that happening in the next? When do you see that happening, or do you see it happening? I mean, I guess my bigger question is like, do you manage that part of your path very much, or are you just more like, I'm a practicus right now. When I'm ready to be philosophist, that's when it'll happen.
I'm at the point right now where I've pretty much memorized all the material for it. I just need to take the test. Mm-hmm. So it's just about just setting it up, I guess. Like, because I'm pretty much ready for it. I just, I'm pretty much ready for it. Within the next six months.
Do you know other philosophy?
Yeah.
You do? Okay. What do you think of their journey? Like, what do you think of their experience of philosophers?
Actually, like, you know what? I guess I'm not really in contact with anyone at the moment that's in philosophers. Like, I'm not in the order at the moment, so I can't really answer that question.
Oh, to be honest with you. And then I guess my other question is, like, what do you think about how's your journey been so far?
Definitely an interesting one, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Even like I was saying, just even getting into the Golden Dawn, like searching through the occult knowledge through the Freemasons, and then just kind of speaking about some esoteric things, and then kind of being pulled aside and saying, like, look, like, this may be an opportunity for you. Like we were discussing before, it was very synchronistic. Mm-hmm. So I feel like my journey has been a magical one, to say the least. Very, like, things lining up at just different moments of time have really worked out for me. The experience of going through the initiations has been an amazing, and meeting different people on the same path, like you were discussing before. It's all about community, and like, even though I'm not an adept, I still have you guys to reach out to, and it's awesome, you know what I mean? Like, because obviously soon I would like to start doing like Enochian work and Solomonic magic, but I'm just kind of sticking with the elemental rituals right now, like the basics, like middle pillar, banishing, invoking, the elements, but nothing too significant. But it's a journey, right? It takes time, so just step by step. But I'm excited. I'm excited for the next path or the next part.
And why, just what you said.
What happened to your order? Sorry, I'm a little confused that you asked him if he's in about going to philosophist. And Matt, you're like, you said you're not in the order right now. What happened?
No. I was in the Toronto order, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, the Cicero one, and everything is great with it. I just decided, like, I was kind of just busy with work at the time, and I was doing a lot of Masonic work as well, like going through the chairs. So I decided to take a break from the Golden Dawn. Like, I was doing the work, but I just wasn't really attending the meetings, and then I just kind of fell out of it, to be honest. And then now I'm really practicing and ready for the next step, so I'll probably get back into it soon.
Very cool. So so the temple, the Cicero's temple in Toronto is still there?
I'm pretty sure.
You just had to pull back for a while. Cool.
Do my own thing.
It's great that they got one going on there. I'm glad to hear that.
For sure. No, there's a few different temples in Ontario, I think. Like, not only the Cicero's, but I know of someone else that's now doing their own thing. So, it's, definitely got some practice.
Sorry for the detour on there, Joseph.
Oh, yeah. No problem.
I just wanted to clarify so I could understand where things are at. Do you want to just keep going for a minute? I just got to run to the loo.
Sure.
Be right back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like your interest, like your long-term interest, is a practical one. I say that because you're talking about Enochian work and Solomonic work, and usually those are means to an end. The end being, you know, changing your life in some way, or changing someone else's life in some way. Changing life, I should say.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because with the Golden Dawn, you can take many different approaches to it. And a lot of people take, I remember, you know, 30 years ago, people were very much into what they called spiritual development, right? Where the practical aspects of the work weren't just, they weren't seen as important as actually, you know, as ascension, right? So like there was this idea of spiritual ascension, and that spiritual ascension was primary, and then sure, occasionally if the shower breaks, then we can fix it with magic or something. But the important part is the spiritual ascension. So some people take that approach, and then other people take a very practical approach. You know, where the idea, you know, where their attitude is, well, what I'm after is truth, right? I can do much more with a little tiny piece of truth than I can with a whole tower of spiritual ascension that doesn't have a lot of truth in it, right? And so the way that they go towards truth is through practical work, where they'll say, you know, okay, you've given me a way to divine through tarot. You've given me a way to work paths. How do I then do something with that? And a lot of people wait until Adeptus Minor to start to begin that work of answering that, right? But you don't have to do it that way. If you want to, you can pursue practical work just as a, I mean, and this isn't entirely for me to call because I'm not in your order. And moreover, this is entirely your journey. So it's not up to me. But I just wanted to bring up that like your questions so far have been practical questions. I'm very much, you probably guess this already, but I'm very much of a practical mindset. And so just with what you have now, you can start to explore truths by doing practical work, by causing, you know, by attempting to make changes in your life.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Maybe you knew that already. You probably did.
I did, yeah, 100%, but it's good to have that reassurance, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For sure.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. But let's see what other questions I have for you guys here.
Yeah.
So.
You guy, I'm the last one standing.
Pretty much, eh? That's hilarious. What time do we have on here? How long has this been going on for?
We've been going since around 1, so now it's 3:30. That's my time. So
yeah, you know what, I might call it in just like a few minutes here, just because I do have to get a few things done today.
Okay,
but 1 second here. I was gonna bring up okay, you might be able to help me out with this, because again, I'm learning the tarot. It's 3 = 8, right? What deck would you start out with? I have the Thoth deck, and I also have the Rider-Waite deck. I love the symbolism in the Thoth, but then also too, it gets me tripped up because of the difference between Zadi being the star or not mm-hmm. being the star. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Zadi not being the star. I'm just wondering, like, what would you go with? Is it like, because I mean, obviously Zadi is the star in the Golden Dawn. I'm not sure. And again, I'm not really there why it would make a difference or not. So what would you go with? Is it cool to just go with the Rider-Waite, or would you go with the with the Thoth deck, what was your recommendation?
My answer is going to be blasphemical to the 90s. My answer is going to be use the Rider-Waite deck. Use the Rider-Waite deck, but moreover, get the book, The Pictorial Key to the Tarot by A.E. Waite, right?
Okay.
And then what you want to do is, so you'll have your Rider-Waite deck, right? And then you'll have The Pictorial Key to the Tarot. What you're going to do is read through The Pictorial Key to just, you don't have to do this, but I'm putting this out there as an experiment because I did this and it was tremendously successful. Yep. Get The Pictorial Key to the Tarot and then just straight up memorize all of the meanings that are given in A.E. Waite. You're going to get like 15 different meanings for a card sometimes, and you're going to get like two different meanings for a card, for another card, like other times, right? Just memorize everything. Memorize all of it. Take absolutely no prisoners and just learn The Pictorial Key to the Tarot, right? So once you have that in your head, right, then just perform the Pictorial Key gives like the tarot reading, like the easiest tarot reading in the world is the Celtic cross spread is at the end of Pictorial Key. Once you have all that knowledge that Waite puts in the book, use Waite's description of a tarot reading and see what your tarot is like.
Okay. I'll give it a go for sure.
Well, I mean, like, if you really give it a go, it's going to take you a long time because you're going to have to memorize like tons of stuff. Yeah. But if you do it and then try a reading with it, just I'd be curious to see what happens.
All right, cool. It's an experiment.
Yeah, but I mean, to answer your question, like, I did the same thing as you. I had the Thoth deck at first, and then I had that thing for like years, right? And then I got the Rider-Waite deck. And I would, you know, first off, I would say that Rider-Waite is probably closer to Golden Dawn style symbolism. But moreover, there's really cool stuff that you can do with the Rider-Waite deck.
Okay.
And listen to the Roger Parasus lecture on the Rider-Waite deck, which is on, is it Adam McLean's YouTube page? He posted at the beginning of COVID, right before COVID, January, right before that, he posted all the recordings of the lectures he had from the Golden Dawn Conference in London in, I think it was like 94 or something, or it was a while back.
What's the video called on YouTube?
Well, I actually have it. I have it on, if you go to Frater RC YouTube page, I have it on a special playlist so that it can be easily found. And Roger Parasus was the secretary. Oh, first off, greetings from the astral plane.
Woo!
Is that great?
Yeah.
Greetings from the astral plane. I didn't wear the shirt that has an inverted pentagram with Bill Gates's head on the front. I'll save that for the next time.
We're missing out.
Hey, just turn on the news if you want some more Satanism and demonism and hopelessness. It's all over the media, so we got plenty of it there. I thought we'd... Anyway, what was the question?
Oh, we were just talking about... He asked the webpage was. But moreover, the original question was, he was like, I'm trying to work on memorizing the tarot. I have the Thoth deck and the Rider-Waite deck. Which deck should I use? Mm-hmm.
The Rider-Waite, I mean, what's fascinating is what's revealed in that lecture. And I think the lecture is actually from the 80s. I think that these lectures are from a Golden Dawn conference in the 80s. Like Bob Gilbert was there. And Roger Parasus was not only the archivist, he was the archivist and secretary for the Theosophical Society in Ireland. And I believe he was also in charge of the Yeats archives for the Yeats family at the time.
So
he really knows what he's talking about, and these lectures only just got released, you know, January 2019, and people still, and I chatted briefly with Tabby about what he says in that lecture about the Rider-Waite, because I read her paper from a Golden Dawn conference either that year or a few years later, and you know, she notices the same things that we all notice, that it looks like the Rider-Waite deck is based on the Wolfram von Eschenbach Parseval Grail legend. But that doesn't take into account why the tools on the magician card are the Celtic gems of the four county, the four areas of Ireland.
Well, they are. I never knew that.
Yeah. They're like, you got the cauldron, right? There's a cauldron, I think, and a stone and a staff or a spear. So they have the Irish magical tools on the Rider-Waite deck. And what Roger Parasius's research showed is that apparently there's a whole narrative system set up that you can see if you display the cards a certain way, like, you know, so I got a little deck that to, once I have more wall space, I'm going to lay them out and see what sort of things I can figure out. He just touches on a bunch of things that no one really has explored since, mainly probably because if you weren't at the lecture live and no papers were produced, and then no one's heard it until just the other year. And so I mentioned it to Tabby. I'm like, have you taken a look at this? Like, we should really look at this, because what it shows is that it wasn't based on the Wolfram von Eschenbach Parsifal Grail story. It was based on a Welsh Grail story. And this came from Yeats. Yeats gave this the directions for all of it to his fellow Gwyldoners, Waite and Pamela Coleman Smith. And he just didn't have time to do a tarot deck. He was very, very busy being one of the most famous writers in the world, you know? Sorry, Crowley. And really, therefore, the deck should be called like the Coleman Yeats deck. It really should be. It really, really should be. But, you know, had to be Rider-Waite. Couldn't have a woman's name on a tarot deck back then. That would be like witchcraft, right?
It would be exactly witchcraft. Like witchcraft back then. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's a bunch of Freemasons, then it's respectable. Very respectable. For memorizing the symbolism, Matt, I really enjoyed throughout my Golden Dawn experience using the Rigardi Wang deck, because the images were so clear and simplified, so that they really stuck out. And they were done in a nice way that I sort of liked, that resonated with me. But yeah, the images, having stark, clear, comprehensible images that your mind can cling onto easily, I find very useful. I also consider the tarot contemplation ritual to be like one of the most misunderestimated rituals out there and practices. I think a lot of people neglect it to their woe. Well, maybe not their woe, because they never know what they're missing, but that's how a lot of magic is. You don't really know what you're missing until you really put in the effort. I mean, this is what the grimoires today are telling us, like Ash and Shasan and all these people, like, hey, yo, if you do all these things right, you can actually get a little bit more than we've been getting from it, like maybe a lot more. And so that's great to hear. It's like, oh cool. Well, let's all try, you know, Solomonic magic with that in mind then, you know, because for a long time that was not really taken very seriously and practiced to the letter. And it's nice that people are now saying, hey, you know, these systems can be pushed a bit further. They can achieve more than that they are currently achieved, but you won't know unless you do that, which is why, like, when I'm doing a lot of purism, purist Enochian these days, right? And having all the right tools, like, if you don't do it with all the right tools made all the right way out of sweet wood and stuff, then you won't know what you can get from having that. It's just that simple. So I think it's worth it.
Is there a purist Golden Dawn?
I would say there certainly is. I mean, there's orders that are, I would call, purist, like Sam Scarborough, and not that it's his order, as he's made very clear to me. For example, I believe they really only have, they follow the exact curriculum as the old order, a bit more or less. So you get the banishing and the invoking pentagram ritual, and then the meditations, and I believe that's it for the entire order. Man, I don't know if I would have stuck with a Golden Dawn if I had joined an order that was like, you know, everything you've learned in all the occult books for the last 5 years? And I'd be like, yeah. They're like, you can't do any of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And all the, you know, the hour of ritual work you're doing every day? Yeah. You can do the first ritual. That's it. And breathing. Can I meditate? Okay, you can meditate. How long do I have to do this for? Like years. Years.
Well, would you have to do it for years though? Didn't we talk about this before? That like the original, in the original Golden Dawn, it was like you were in the Outer Order for a year.
Yeah, like year, year and a half, maybe 2 years, yeah. Depending on things. Yeah.
But the official, I forget what the regimen is. Isn't it something like the symbolic regimen? I think they say it in 5-6. It's like, it's something like 7 months as a philosophist, 9 months as a portal.
Yeah, but yeah, so that came along later. I mean, the 7 months as philosophist is definitely a very later addition, definitely. They had a tradition, they often would, you know, ask for 3 months in practice and stuff, but portal, like, I mean, portal was, when it was first created, it was filling in a stopgap that they needed, but for all the, because they had all these nominal adepti, they had all these nominal 5-6 people who had passed their philosophist exams, and but they didn't have time to get the initiation yet, and the initiation made, you know, didn't actually even exist right away, so they were just nominal 5-6 adepti. Mm-hmm. And they had to like do all kinds of shenanigans to like sort of separate them from the real 5-6, and they needed something to fill that space, and then the portal came along and did that, gave them that thing, and then they came up with a 9-month thing after the fact, which is funny because, you know, it's funny how, well, traditionalists will very, very much cling to these traditions and like they are sacrosanct without really acknowledging that they occurred in a time and a place and for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and if you keep going back to the purest, truest form of this tradition, well, all you get is three guys talking about starting an order. So it's the pure Golden Dawn.
If you want to be part of the pure Golden Dawn,
become a Mason, right. Find two friends and talk about starting a Golden Dawn.
Exactly. That's where the purest Golden Dawn would be.
That was it.
Join the SRIA and then find somebody creative to write an initiation ritual. Congratulations, you have discovered the pure Golden Dawn.
And then
Dawn
someone's part. Like, oh, really? Well, we do pentagram rituals in our Golden Dawn. It's like, oh, well, you're a later innovator. You represent that tradition. Once they started doing initiations and rituals and stuff like that, we're part of the Ur Golden Dawn that predates all the rituals and all of that sort of spiritual practices and meditation nonsense, right?
So who created the LBRP?
It developed.
What a great question. Developed.
There's rumors that they learned it from Eliphas Levi, of course.
And can you break down the psychology of it? Like, obviously, like, you're using the four cardinal directions, the four archangels, and the four holy names. But, like, what is the psychology? I mean, obviously, it can be used for different things, right? Like, banishing, invoking the different elements. But, like, why do we use the holy names before the archangels? And, I mean, yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's because you always start invoking from the highest in the Golden Dawn tradition.
Oh, okay.
You'll see Goetic people argue about this all the time. They're like, which name should we do first? And some people will say, like, you should do the higher names first. And they'll be like, no, that's a Golden Dawn thing. We should invoke the lowest names first and whatever. You'll hear people debate that. Definitely in the Golden Dawn, we invoke from the highest first, which is why you have the divine names in each of the four quarters. And then you have the archangels afterwards. That would make sense. But again, the ritual developed and didn't start at that point. It started as them just like you would just do a pentagram, and as you were drawing the pentagram, you'd project into it everything you wanted to get rid of if you're banishing, right? And then you would use the divine name and project into it. Actually, before the sign of the entry, you just stab into it, and you would use the divine name to get rid of everything that you wanted to get rid of that you had projected into that pentagram. That was like the sort of proto understanding of the LBRP, as far as I have read, is how it started, and then it developed out of there. But it was never used elementally to have anything to do with the four elements and the four quarters. That was never a part of the LBRP or LIRP at all. And the archangels were originally just visualized as columns of white light. They were not, they had no images or color association whatsoever. And the LBRP wasn't, LIRP wasn't seen as having anything to do with the elements, just invoking God and spirit into your sphere and setting it as a, you know, as in its places around the four quarters to protect you and all of these things, whether you're invoking or banishing. The LBRP and LIRP are equally protective, whether you're invoking or banishing. So it was, you know, if you were doing an operation that you wanted to gain something or like an invocation, you would start your rituals with an LIRP. If you wanted to do a ritual to get rid of something, you would start your ritual work with an LBRP.
Yeah.
So that's interesting, I think.
Oh, definitely. So with the flashing colors of the archangels, and I guess what I was going to say is you're envisioning the archangels, you're envisioning the flashing colors. And we were discussing how magic, obvious, like if there's real, there's results to be had, evocation, there's going to be spirits. However, the LBRP, you're imagining the archangels. Has there ever been a time where the imagination becomes so real, so vivid that it almost, you feel the presence of the archangels?
Oh, for sure, yeah. Well, you see, the like idea
almost beyond the imagination.
Of course, because whenever you create a god form, this core Golden Dawn magical theory is whenever you create a god form or an egregore, the purpose, like you may be creating it microcosmically or just within yourself, if that kind of thinking is helpful to use at all. It may not be, especially it didn't exist in the grimoire times, and they just saw it, you know, spirit. Just doing this within spirit. If it's helpful to think of it as a micro macro, then so be it. But if you're creating something, an egregore, a representational force, you're sympathetically drawing the force it represents to it. So the more strong that you create these egregores of archangels and call the archangels to you, the more they are attracting the actual nascent source of what they're representing themselves, and you create this drawing effect. So you do interact more and more with the actual, some sort of representation of the spirit itself, right? Archangels are just so different from chthonic or Enochian spirits, right? They're very, very different, and they're good for general things and general answers, and but they're not necessarily the most physically manifest beings right off the bat, unless you're going to do a full evocation and all of that.
Gotcha.
I guess the only thing that I wanted to say was for the LBRP, it goes back to what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Remember when John Shax was on before, and he was talking
about Frater Mercurio.
Frater Mercurio was on before, and he was talking about how how the invocation of the higher genius itself is to do that, right? Like if you want to have something to do, then what all the ruach is doing is it's essentially the job of a janitor, right? Where you're keeping everything clean, you're keeping everything organized, you're managing everything, but ultimately the job of that ruach is passive, right? And it's passive so that the spirit can descend, right? When you're doing these LBRPs over, you know, when you're in the outer and you're going through these elemental grades, you're doing the LBRP like all the time, right? That is that work of clearing everything out, right? And then besides that, think for a second about what it is exactly that's happening, right? You're going through these elemental grades and you're performing the LBRP in each of these elemental grades. So you're being initiated into these elemental grades, and then you're performing the LBRP over and over and over and over again, right? You're getting this deep clean of each of these elements, right? So that by the time that you hit the end, you will have deep cleaned all of the elements, right? So that then during portal, you can start to bring in the spirit. Yeah. So I guess I don't even remember the question. It's just as RC was talking about stuff, I was like, I want to say something about the Outer Order. And so there it is.
Yeah, I could feel it, brother. That's why I threw it to you. Let's clarify for the listeners also, when you say LBRP, it's all you mean also LIRP, of course. It's just common to say LBRP, but obviously you're doing LIRPs as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Every day. Yeah. It's that's one thing that is a sort of a sticking point in the community right now. I think as you both probably noticed is because it's in common parlance since Rigardi to talk about it as the LBRP, magicians, you generally refer to the LBRP as a lot of magicians say LBRP, even when they're talking about the invoking form.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that can throw a lot of people off and think that you're only doing the LBRP, but of course you're doing the LIRP. Like,
obviously. It depends on, I remember this actually came up during my Outer Order work. And I remember my proctor at the time was like, well, during elemental grades, you really want to do the LIRP of whatever element it is you're working with at the time.
That was an innovation by our order, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We invented that was completely our own thing.
That's all us.
The Cicero's order would ever know what you're talking about changing the LIRP to a different direction. They look at that quite,
they look at it askance.
Yeah. I think it's actually one of the most brilliant things that came out of our order. I think it's brilliant. What an amazing innovation. Is it different? Yes, it's not the same thing as the normal LIRP. Of course not. And it can't. When you change a ritual, you don't create a different version of that ritual. You create a new ritual, right? Like the greater ritual of the pentagram and hexagram that Crowley created isn't a version of the supreme ritual of the pentagram and hexagram.
It's sure.
A different ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens when you change rituals. They become new rituals. So we would try and invoke the element of the grade that you're in through the pentagrams, and it seemed to work. Everyone found it worked. Thousands of people for decades found it incredibly effective. So for all the people who say you can't do that and it's wrong and it's not Golden Dawn, well, yeah, it's new, it's made up, just like all the other stuff as the tradition has grown, was invented and tested and tried, and that has a great sample set. If you want to talk about sample sets, magicians want to talk about results-based magic. You had thousands of people trying this throughout all the grades for decades and worked pretty damn well. So for all those naysayers out there, then again, but do I think everyone should be doing that? No, I don't think it's necessary. Just the basic LIRP for, you know, summoning spirit into your sphere is great. Nothing wrong with being in the elemental grades and bringing in spirit every day. Like that makes sense. And then it's filling up. You already have the spirits and the beings of the watchtowers charged and set to the task of doing magical effects within your being, with like they're tasked with transforming you and purifying you and challenging you in ways that makes you grow and develop and become more than human, I guess. And but the purification, I think, is a big part of it, as that elemental energy is infused through the connection with the watchtower and regulated through the initiation ceremony itself to function a certain way. It brings out parts of our ego, right? It brings out parts of our ruach and emphasizes them, the good and the bad. And so you have to learn to balance those things as each of them come up. And in that process, Frederick Yakuta has an interesting point I was reading the other day in one of his Enochian books about how it's a really great way to slowly build up what your container of yourself is capable of holding energetically, so that by the time you get to Enochian and stuff like that, your body is more capable of handling the amount of energy that is being dumped into you without, you know, losing your shit and burning out or whatever.
Hey, we're right at the end, I guess. Because
are we? I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's been a weird one.
Yeah, it's been a weird one. We bounced two different places. There was a long gap where great things were said, and I think I think Matt, I mean, obviously Matt taught us because Matt is secretly the greatest one among us, but he doesn't know it yet. So it's going to take him a while, but once he knows, dynamite.
Oh, that was a great convo. Honestly, I really appreciate your time, Joseph, and and John's as well, and Edwards for setting this up, and Frater RC for having me on the show. Thank you so much, guys. Like, your explanations, your time. I really appreciate everything. Seriously, from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah, pleasure to meet you, Matt. Very nice. And you know, maybe we can try again when Edward has stable internet or something like that.
100%. I'd love to. I'd love to.
Yeah, and really... Matt, if you know, if you have any other questions, if you're like, if especially if you're going through a hard time, like everybody in the Outer Order, if you don't go through a hard time, you're going to go through a hard time later. So like any challenges that you have, any like, you know, or if you just want to say that you're succeeding happily or something like that, please reach out. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. I don't know. I guess I'll, maybe I'll just send this recording to Edward and he can stitch it into the first part or something.
Yeah. I'd like to see how he edits it.
Who knows, folks? I don't know how you're going to hear this stuff, but somehow you'll hear it.
Take care, guys. Cheers.
All right. All right. Peace. See you later.
An extension.
Thanks. Good seeing you again, RC.
Yeah, likewise, Joe. All right. Peace, guys.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a 6-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new Grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.